excited to introduce Jiru, who's been a friend and Dharma brother of mine for many years, practicing together at Asahara and Green Gulch Farm, where he currently lives and has come down from the Zen Center in the north to be with us tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the kind invitation. It's wonderful to be back here. I think I was here last week or something, and I was looking through a folder and noticed that it was March of last year. So, wow, it's come to this. The year is just gone. So it's great to be here. My name is Jiru. My wife, Sarah, and baby Frank are there back. Reverend Kokyo told me that you all celebrated the Buddha's parinirvana, the Buddha's passing away, which is a ceremony we also observed at Green Gulch Farm and probably at Zen centers throughout the world. There was a scene that's been in my mind, a moment from the Maha Parinirvana Sutta, the sutta that tells about the Buddha's death. It's kind of a very dramatic moment where the Buddha is dying and his close disciples are at his deathbed, and maybe his dearest disciple, Ananda, has just received some final teachings, some last instructions from the Buddha, and he's just overwhelmed with appreciation for his teacher and also with this loss of his teacher in his final moments. And so he leaves the presence of the Buddha and he goes into the temple and leans against a doorstop and weeps. And the Buddha says, where did Ananda go? And the other disciples say, well, he's leaning against a doorstop weeping, you know. And the Buddha, says, please bring, you know, call him, bring him here. I want to talk to him. So Ananda comes back to the Buddha and sort of silently sits down at his side. And the Buddha says, enough, Ananda. Do not grieve, do not lament. For have I not taught from the very beginning that with all that is dear and beloved, there must be change, separation, and severance. Of that which is born, come into being, compounded, and subject to decay, how can one say, may it not come to dissolution? There can be no such state of things. Get over it, Ananda. See clearly, your weeping, your loss at my passing is delusion, is your own attachment, your own holding on to this view that things should stay the same, that these compounded, transient things should stay the same. But there can be no such state of things. So this clear, strong, and rather cold admonition of the Buddha to his disciple to really wake up, to snap out of his sentimentality and see that the Buddha's passing is like the leaf falling, is the nature of this transient world. Everything is unreliable, everything is marked with transience and suffering. And if you see that, then you won't grieve. You won't think that there was some Buddha that came into existence that's now passing out of existence. So inviting this clear eye that appreciates impermanence and emptiness. So I had remembered that part of the sutta, that strong, cold, clear teaching of the Buddha. But when I was looking through that story again, I noticed the part that comes right after that, which is this whole section, several verses, where the Buddha praises Ananda. So he first admonishes him in this kind of cold way, and then he just heaps, verse after verse, just heaps on these praises. Ananda, my dear disciple, you have been such a wonderful companion. He praises how he brings joy to others, how people without fail are joyful around Ananda, and how Ananda has always known the proper time for when to bring people to the Buddha. So this incredible warmth coming from the Buddha, following this sort of, don't be sad, Ananda, just wake up. And it's like, Ananda, you're so great, my sweet dear disciple. This kind of outpouring of warmth and humanity of the Buddha meeting his disciple and just offering this this love and appreciation, this consolation, to this grieving disciple. First thing, you don't need to grieve because things aren't like this. But then still consoling him. It's the kind of Pali version of a hug in these verses that follow. In Ananda bhikkhus are to be found four rare and superlative qualities. That's like, Ananda, you're great. I love you so much. It's been such a joy to live this life together. So it was nice to re-meet the Buddha in that way. I sometimes feel he's a little bit cold in these older teachings. But when I get into it, I see there's this incredible warmth. So there's this grief, and also this warmth, and also this clarity, or this wisdom. And that's what I wanted to talk about this evening. Maybe not not necessarily about the Buddha's dying, although maybe that may on some occasions strike us as tremendously sad. But all the other passings and changings and ills and sufferings that we experience in our own lives and in the life of the world, we're surrounded by images of pain and despair and brokenness. And I think really deeply at some level feel that the world is out of whack, that things are not how they should be. My wife and I recently watched this movie called Gasland about the harvesting of natural gas and how it's basically destroying waterways, which is the foundation of life. And I think we can all bring to mind these images of war and poverty and environmental devastation. There's so much to grieve, to feel is broken. And as bodhisattvas, as beings whose life in the world, whose vow is to benefit, is to help, is to heal and to fix this world, opening to that suffering, opening to that grief is really central to our practice, to have that capacity to really take in the magnitude of the suffering and the pain of the world. Avalokiteshvara, the one who hears the cries of the world, so open to that terrible sound of the cries of the world. So I think we all have maybe some images in particular that we carry, I think, of how the world is not what it should be. And I think it's good to really open to that, to really feel that and meet that as part of who we are and part of how we are in the world. But while we do that, in the midst of that, I feel that we should also stay close to this kind of cold clarity of the Buddha, and to not be fooled, even when we're facing clear and sometimes extreme suffering, to really have this kind of eye of wisdom that sees clearly and that isn't fooled by our own kind of sentimentality and limited views. So the sense that basically the world is okay, no matter what is happening. I wanted to read from a piece I wrote for Buddha Dharma magazine that's about this. I want to read a piece of this and then talk some more about this. One chaotic day in the temple kitchen in the first years of my residential Zen practice, as I ran harried with a pan of food from the oven to the buffet table, my teacher stopped me in my tracks. As he walked through the dining room doors, he took one glance at me and said, "It's okay." "It's okay? It's okay?" How did he know it was okay? What if it weren't okay? On what basis could he make such a claim? Despite my 10,000 doubts, I knew that his unconditional okay was precisely what I had come to Buddhism to find. It was the quiet koan at the core of my practice, the longing that would push me in my practice. All of my seeking boiled down to a quest to discover how my teacher knew it's okay, whether or not he even knew what it was. So I say a little bit about my family and values that were instilled in me of really appreciating the magnitude and enormity and intractability of the suffering in the world. So I write, "The world I inherited was thus a broken, unjust world, a world unspeakably far from okay. And who would dare to say otherwise in the face of endless wars, ecological devastation, starvation, oppression? Who among us would have the gall to walk through the dining room doors of the world and proclaim it's okay? Maybe to a healthy young monk in a temple kitchen, but to struggling farmers displaced from their land, their water polluted, to the widowed, the orphaned, the maimed. And yet, to ground our compassion, we must find just that gall. In the Dharma, I found the invitation to say with full confidence, sometimes silently and sometimes aloud, that no matter what, it's okay. I need to work and ask for help to keep that okay from becoming lazy or complacent, but I have no doubt that the bedrock of my bodhisattva activity must be it's okay. So not from desperate brokenness, but from the clarity and ease of okay, may we bear witness to the suffering of the world and wholeheartedly work to heal it and ourselves." So this to me seems like the vital heart of the Buddha Dharma, of Buddhist practice. Opening to our grief is difficult and a very special thing to do. But even more difficult and rare, I think, is to find a teaching and a way of life that's convincingly teaches and expresses that at the bottom of things, it's okay. Holding the grief and the pain and the brokenness, but completely rooted in it's okay. Unshakable in that. Is maybe what most inspires me about the Buddha way. So I met somebody at Green Gulch recently who was telling me, we didn't have much time together, and she was telling me about work that she does with troubled youth, at-risk youth and these troubled families, and her really wanting to help these kids and really do some good in their life, heal them and help them. And also this very, very intimate with the difficulty of that, the impossibility of that, that no matter how much she does, the forces that are, you know, against them are so great. And I think she felt that need to fix and also that impossibility of fixing. And she saw that burnout was near. And we didn't have much time, and I think I was in kind of a Zen mood. So I said something like, Well, you just have to realize that everything is perfectly okay as it is, and then there's no problem. Which later felt a little incomplete, say. No less true, no less true, but a little glib. So I was relieved that she got in touch with me a little later and said, I was interested in what you said, and it didn't make any sense. I'd like to know how to do that. And I said, well, thank you, because that's kind of a ridiculous thing to say to somebody. So the question is, how? How do we find that? You know, well, we'll just see emptiness, and then all your problems will go away. It's true. That's really all there is to say. No, but how? So how do we find that everything is okay, no matter what it is? And that's in the story. My teacher, you know, when I would go to meet him, before I opened my mouth about what was wrong, he knew it was okay. So one feeling I have is that to find this okay is to have a ground that's beyond our mind. So our mind says that there's some things that are okay, there's some things that are not okay, there's good and bad, there's the well-functioning and the things that need fixing. So we're making these distinctions constantly, but reality doesn't seem to correspond to the distinctions that we're making about what should and shouldn't be happening. So I feel that we have this kind of choice point when reality is doing something and our idea about what reality should do is something else. We can get behind our mind or we can get behind reality. And it seems wise, my opinion, to take the side of reality at any given moment. But to do that is to actually be a little bit bigger than our mind, to have the ability to step out of our mind and accord with reality rather than our mind when they're in conflict, means knowing ourselves in a way that's kind of bigger than our mind. So in practicing Zazen, I think in practicing the Dharma, that's part of what we cultivate, is this ground that doesn't have kind of the mind as the only recourse. When we're just according with reality, when we're just on the side of reality, then there's no ground from which we could say that it's not okay. Reality is complete and whole and is unfolding completely as itself. Nothing can come in from outside and like set reality going the wrong direction. From the point of view of reality, or you could say suchness or things as they are, there are no mistakes. There's nothing that shouldn't be. As soon as we make some judgment like that, we're back in our mind. And it's a good place to be. It's an important skill to have, being in the mind. But it becomes our kind of only trick. And obstructs us from understanding or say from finding the equanimity and the balance of being grounded in reality. Another thing that comes up for me is not knowing. So another practice that we cultivate, not knowing. So when we sit, we might find that when we sit in Zazen and really let go, we sort of forget a little bit who we are, and we kind of forget a little bit what things are, and we invite this not knowing. So not only do I not know who I am, or who you are, or what this is, I don't know that it's not okay. You know, I sort of forgot that it wasn't okay, not in some kind of turning away or rejecting way, but just I actually don't I can't grasp what things are. So how could I say that something that I don't know what it is not okay? And with this not knowing and this groundedness in reality, there's fearlessness. There's nothing to fear. A lot can do harm to me, basically like everything can harm me, but nothing can harm reality. So if my only mode is me and my mind, then I'm basically under constant threat. But finding the ground of reality, being willing to let things be how they are, then they're never not going to be that way. They're never going to be damaged from being how they are. So there's nothing to be afraid of. One image of this is, you know, these stories, I'm sure it happens, you see them on TV and stuff, where there's some, you know, the school bus falls on the kid and the person leaps in and just tosses off the school bus, you know, by some power completely not their own. And I think that's whether or not any of us have actually seen that happen, I think it's a powerful image of this sort of not knowing and fearlessness and skillful, helpful, appropriate action. So there's not this kind of assessment like, oh, that's a school bus and that's a kid and that's really not okay, so I'm going to run over there and flip the school bus over. It's more this kind of according with reality, this being being lined up with how things are and what's actually happening, frees up this kind of natural energy and activity. So part of our difficulty, it's already really difficult to accept things as they are, to believe, to know that everything is completely okay as it is. That's already really difficult. Then we have this idea that makes it even more difficult, which is that if I just accepted everything, then I would be totally complacent. I would stop doing any good at all. But I think this image shows in a way, or is an example of a kind of activity, helpful, beneficial activity that comes also from a ground bigger than kind of rejection or acceptance, or that's not based on a kind of fundamental rejection of reality. So I think that idea is kind of poisonous, that idea that to accept things as they are will somehow cut us off from helping. Rejecting reality, not having room for something, denying and pushing away, averting from things, actually clouds our energy and clouds our ability to act and clouds our skillfulness. We lose the ground when we're cutting up reality into these pieces that are supposed to be there and these pieces that aren't supposed to be there. It's like we're cutting out our own ground. How can we find this natural responsive energy to help? I think there is a way that that we can be sort of superficial and lazy in our practice and use some idea about things being okay as an excuse to not really make any effort. But that's not what I'm talking about, and I think it's not what Zen is talking about. There's actually a word for that in Zen, which is Buji Zen, or nothing matters, or nothing is, you know. So it's like everything's fine, so there's no need to practice. But our practice is actually discovering, finding that everything is okay, and that's actually really hard. It's not like, oh, everything's okay, so I don't have to practice. It's like everything's okay, so I really need to practice hard to realize that, because I don't realize that right now. So so being grounded in that everything is okay, I feel, doesn't stop our working to improve the world. It's actually the opposite. It energizes us and grounds us and enables us in a way that rejection and aversion and denial and hatred simply don't. So not only do we become more effective helpers, but we also can enjoy our life a little more and enjoy the world. But certain things, it seems like, okay, you know, maybe okay so far, you know, you can agree the Buddha, you know, Ananda shouldn't have been so sad about the Buddha because death is inevitable and, you know, there's a hurricane. I guess these days we understand that we cause hurricanes, so that's maybe not such a good example, but say there's a hurricane that we didn't cause, that's somehow easier to accept. Okay, reality is like nature. And nature is that things die and there's hurricanes and disease and stuff. So I'll accept those things. I can accept that because that's nature. But certain things are unacceptable. That, sir, is unacceptable. And in thinking about this word and that feeling of unacceptable, I find that it's very close to blame. If I can blame somebody for something, then it's not acceptable. If there's no one to blame, it's like, well, okay, I guess it just had to be that way, I can accept it. But if you made that happen, then why should I have to accept that? You should have not done that, or I should stop you from continuing to do that rather than accept it. So thinking in that way is a big pile of delusions. It's a basic misunderstanding about how things work. The wisdom of emptiness, the wisdom of the Buddha Dharma, is that there is no one to blame. There's not some inherently existing individual self out there who, through their own will, has somehow created the volition to do some bad thing that they then carry out by their own power. If that were the case, we would really have ground to blame them. But seeing the world in a more whole and bigger way, we can open to this kind of joined reality, sort of unified reality, where there aren't identifiable, independent, much less evil actors who are going around doing stuff that shouldn't be done. There are, and we know that, and we feel that, and we can express that. But to never believe that, I think, is the path of the Dharma. To never, even if we play that, or even if we need to say that, to never actually completely buy this idea that we're all these little individuals with all this power to decide what we do and then do it. There's a favorite koan of mine, is simply the question, how does the person of great strength raise an arm? Mm. You know, not by themselves, not alone, not by their own power. That's how we think about the world, that's how we tend to perceive it. But that is quite simply deluded. That's not how things happen. That's not how the universe unfolds. So there's no one to blame. And fundamentally, there's nothing to fix. Mm-hmm. Everything just as it is. In our own mind, in our own confusion, and in this broken and dying world, there is nothing that isn't okay. That's pretty much what I wanted to say this evening. One final thought is inspired by recalling Norman Fisher, Zen Center abbot and teacher of mine, who said in response to Robert Thurman speaking, who's this amazingly passionate and clear and bright and colorful and sort of wild and brilliant teacher in the Tibetan lineage. Norman said something like, you know, these people, these like Tibetan Buddhists are into this sort of cosmology and this cosmic career and this, and Zen is about like getting through the day. You know, like if I can like get through today. So thinking about that, I thought, you know, it's okay. Like we can actually do better. We can do even better than it's okay. Like how about it's completely perfect? How about it's bright flowers and jewels reflecting? You know, what about this vision of the universe, this vision of how things actually are, that's actually much brighter and much more exuberant and joyful and perfect than we can even imagine? I think for now, okay is kind of good enough for me. But in the back of my mind there, I feel that little reach. Like, not just okay. Okay is key, and okay is the bottom. But even beautiful, you know, even perfect, even completely fulfilled Buddha wisdom and Buddha virtue. As another teacher of mine used to say constantly, everything is complete Buddha wisdom and fulfilled Buddha virtue. Which makes no sense. No, it's not. Everything. That thing that for you is not okay in yourself or in the world, that is a blossoming flower, a radiant jewel, is perfected Buddha wisdom and virtue. So I think that vision, that story, that vision, I think can really serve us in working against this sense of brokenness and despair. Right. Forgive me for speaking a little longer than I had hoped. I wonder if there are some thoughts or some feelings you want to share? Hi. Thank you.
Stating with accuracy what is obvious, nothing more or less. So that also includes something like when something really sucks, saying, mm-hmm. This really sucks. Mm-hmm. When I sit in meditation, I am observing everything, and I am simply stating or trying to what it is. Mm-hmm. Part of my feelings. Maybe awful feelings. Mm-hmm. But there is something in the observation of the awful feelings, mm-hmm. that is serene. Mm-hmm. That is at one with everything it is. Mm-hmm. That's all I can say, is kind of an experience. Mm-hmm. And out of that comes what I feel is an impulse towards appropriate action. Mm-hmm. And it generally moves in the direction of being helpful in some way. Does that practice comport with your idea of acceptance?
Yeah. For me, I appreciate that practice. I think for me, it's maybe naming, and I guess the act of naming is an act of including in a way. And that's the key for me, is this too is included. So I say this sucks, and it's included. I don't, and I would also maybe add, like, my mind perceives now, at this moment, there is this mind perceiving suckiness, you know. Rather, when we say stating the obvious, we might assume that, you know, that it's obvious to say that this is a piece of paper, but that's a little strong, it's kind of a strong statement, you know, to say this is a piece of paper. It seems obvious, but it's also, the more basic fact is maybe like perception of a piece of paper. But basically, what you're describing is including, and so just saying this is, and by its isness is okay, is included. So I feel appreciation for what you're saying, and that is the practice inwardly and outwardly of receiving and opening awareness to. Thank you. Hi.
The notion of things being okay exclude compassion?
That's central to me. I feel like not at all. It in a way it is compassion, or it's the ground of compassion. How do you see it? Do you suspect that maybe it does, or? Yeah.
Otherwise, there'd be no bodhisattva way.
Yeah.
There'd be no reason to save all beings.
Right.
If everything was just okay as it is, and our actions wouldn't assist.
Mm-hmm.
Even though that's judgment,
right.
I understand that's a judgment.
Right.
I think I hold both.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the Buddha was also holding both for me in a way in that story, you know, of being willing to have a very human, be very human, you know, and also to not be fooled. So I think it's, I guess sometimes we imagine that compassion excludes okayness, you know, and I guess that's what I'm concerned with, but it's true the other way too, that we can, find some kind of okayness that doesn't include compassion, but I think they include each other. Most kind of alive for me right now is to kind of cut through that sense that to be compassionate, I have to think things are really messed up. I have to really get torn up about things to be compassionate. I feel like, no, actually, to be really compassionate, I need to be completely okay. But thank you, that is what this is in the service of, really. Thank you.
How do you explain things that just on a primal level seem so viscerally wrong, like war or the Holocaust or human sacrifice or trafficking and slavery or those types of things?
Yeah. Those are precisely the things that that we need to let in and investigate, you know, and see. So I explain, I suppose, that they're okay by invoking that they are. they are included. They are here. And I choose, in a way, to say that what's here is not wrong. What's here is not a problem. I don't have some position. I can't find some position outside of reality, outside of how things are, to say that they're wrong. How can I judge reality? Where would I stand to say reality is wrong? I don't know how I got here. I don't know where I am fundamentally. You know, I didn't make up the world. Who am I to tell the world how it should be? Everything is just received. So I don't mean that we shouldn't grieve, because that's what we do. We do perceive this wrong, but I think not being distressed that reality is doing what reality does, and not really holding to this idea that reality should be some other way. So I don't even want that to be satisfactory. So please don't be satisfied. but that's what I'm exploring. It's exactly those darkest places, and
it seems to me like there are some things that you should get really angry about, fight back.
Yeah. Yeah, but part of what I'm suggesting is that starting with accepting, starting with saying this universe is exactly how it is, and I accept that, starting with that, and then helping, rather than just being in this chaos of this kind of crazy situation where there's some things that are supposed to be here, and then there's like a bunch of things. Most things aren't supposed to be here. I don't know how you can find your ground in a world like that. And so then I think, even though you have this very genuine intention to help, without that ground, it's also hard to see how the helping happens. So and I also feel that in our practice we can find some subtleness, you know. Maybe it's not even so conscious or graspable, you know, but just this subtle, can be a subtle ease with things, you know. This acceptance that gives us the capacity to not freak out when something awful is happening. So for me, that not freaking out means, okay, it's okay. Now what, you know? But just like, oh my God, it's not okay. I think it's not true, fundamentally, and I think it's not helpful. But I really appreciate the question, and that's kind of what I'm exploring. So I don't know.
Me too.
Okay, thank you. Sorry.
Very provocative, and I guess especially in relation with this last question, I'm thinking. Several things. One is, I don't necessarily hear you suggesting that you wouldn't take action, that this equanimity of accepting what is, I think I heard you say that doesn't mean a passivity.
Right.
Did I hear that correctly, or am I just imagining that?
That's right. If it's passivity, I'd say it's kind of superficial, it's okay. And yeah.
If I'm in a position where I want to, you know, fight some injustice or try to contribute to somebody's well-being, and I'm doing this from a position of, well, it's not okay, you're not okay, I'm the one that can help you, poor thing, mm-hmm. You know, there's a way that it would feel like saying this is how it is and taking action to try to make the world better. I'll say it, you know, you might disagree with me, but actually, no, I want to make the world better, and I'm going to do it from this place of, it couldn't be anything other than it is right now. So I'm not going to invest my energy in fighting what is. I'm going to put my energy into acting towards being, you know, the enactment of my thought. But you are okay. You know, and even if I'm trying to, quote unquote, help you, you're not this poor thing over there. Yeah. So that's kind of where I was exploring my own being as I was listening to your putting out these ways of working in this difficult area of our practice.
Thank you.
What do you think?
Yeah, I appreciate that. The it's not okay is a kind of arrogance that you know that you're connecting that closely to I'm going to help you. Anyway, I feel that this kind of arrogance that separates ourselves above the world and then pass judgment on whether it's okay or not. It seems like the height of arrogance in a way. So this humility of accepting how things are and then completely doing what's natural, which is, oh, Ananda, come here. I love you so much. You've been such a good friend. So we're out of time. I know there's some other comments. May we continue this conversation forever. And may the conversation somehow bring real and lasting benefit to this suffering world. Thank you. Possible.